Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this is the Purim edition, 5768. It is officially for Shabbat, Parshat Tzav. I don't think we'll get to too much of the Parsha of the week, because first broadcast of this is Thursday, Ta'anit Esther, shortly before Megillah reading. And I suspect that people will be listening to it on Ta'anit Esther, Purim night, Purim day, and beyond. So it is really going to be focused on Purim, and that will include a couple of weird features, which might not have anything to do with Purim, but they sort of fit the mood of a little bit of levity that is introduced at this time of the year. The recording is being done on Wednesday. I'm trying to beat the fast day in for tomorrow so that there are other things that I'll be involved with doing on Ta'anit Esther. We have a full program starting from a shiur in the afternoon through Mincha and another shiur, and then Ma'ariv, and then Megillah reading, and then fast breaking refreshments. So, if I could finish it today, Wednesday, that would be good. But because this is being broadcast at that time when we will not be saying Tachanun anymore, instead of Psalm 130, we will do Psalm 121, Tehillim Kuf Kaf Aleph. Shir Lama Alot, Esa Einai El Heharim, Me'ayin Yavo Ezri, Ezri Me'im Adonai Osei Shamayim Va'oretz. Al yitain lamot raglecha al yanum shomerecha. Hine lo yanum velo yishan shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomerecha, Adonai tzilecha al yad yeminecha. Yomam hashemesh lo yakeka v'yareach baloyla. Adonai yishmorcha mikol ra yishmor et nafshecha. Adonai yishmor tzeitecha uvoecha me'ata v'yad olam. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya ha'omidim bein bayam ובין ביבשה, המקום ירחם עליהם ויוציאם מצורה לרווחה, מאפלה לאורה ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב, ונאמר אמן. In case you were wondering why the show started with the opening chords of Dragnet, it's because I got it into my head to play a piece from back in 1953, I can't exactly say it's before my time, but I don't remember it from back then. But I remember my father, Zichrono Levracha, having a 45 disc. This was on one side. It was called St. George and the Dragonet. And it was really a train of thought that brought me there. I started thinking of what fun piece I could play. And what always comes to my mind is Who's on First with Abbott and Costello. And I've done that in the past. I don't think I've done St. George and the Dragonet, so I decided, I downloaded it, and I will include it a little bit later in the show. But first, I'd like to put two things into perspective. That is Ta'anit Esther, the Fast of Esther, which is Thursday, and a custom of Thursday afternoon called Zecher L'Machatzit HaShekel, both of which I discussed in a short mini-shir to the folders a very short time ago. The Mishnah in Masechet Shkalim, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when we had Shabbat Parshat Shkalim, the Mishnah in Shkalim says, Be'echad ba'adar, on the first day of Adar, Mashmi'in al ha-Shkalim va'al ha-Kilayim. There were two announcements that were made around the country to remember to gather your pennies together, go to the money changer and get your silver half shekel, and it will be collected sometime during the month of Adar. And also check your fields to see if you have wheat or barley growing in a vineyard. Okay. We commemorate the mitzvah of machatzit hashekel, the mitzvah of giving a half shekel, in two ways. On the Shabbat Av, or before Rosh Chodesh Adar, we read a special maftir called Parshat Shkalim. And the other way is we give a zecher l'machatzit hashekel, and some of the Sfarim say you have to be very clear that you're not doing machatzit hashekel, you're doing a commemoration of machatzit hashekel. And they say it for a very important reason. If you were to give a coin and say, this is machatzit hashekel, the coin becomes forbidden to use for any purpose other than the Beit HaMikdash. And we don't have a Beit HaMikdash at this moment, which means the money has to be saved someplace and held for that time. So you say, I am giving in commemoration of the machatzit hashekel. The tradition is that that money goes either to poor people or to a poor Talmid Chacham or to a yeshiva that supports poor Talmidei Chachamim. And there are various and sundry other questions, whatever. Now, the minimum commemoration of the machatzit hashekel is a half coin of the realm, which means if you live in the United States, you give a half dollar. If you live in France, a half franc. If you live in England, a half pound. And if you are fortunate enough to live in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, you give a coin that happens to be called a half shekel, which is very nice. The second level of the custom is to give three half shekel coins, total of a shekel and a half. The reason for three is the phrase Teruma Lashem, a gift to God, is mentioned three times in Parshat Shkalim, in Parshat Ki Tisa, in Shmot. And they say that in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, there were three occasions during the year that they collected machatzit hashekel, not just once a year. So the custom is to give three half shekel. There is a further layer to the custom, and that is to give an amount equal to the original silver half shekel. According to various sources that I've seen, the original half silver shekel contained 10 grams of silver. 10 grams of silver at today's prices of silver and today's conversion rate for the dollar to the shekel comes to approximately 22 and a half shekel. So if a person wants to do this minhag, 22 and a half shekel. If a person wants to do this minhag, it's a minhag. If he wants to do it in the best way, the top way, the premium version of Zecher L'Machatzit HaShekel, he gives 22 and a half shekel. The minimum is a half shekel, and the best minimum, I don't know if that's the best way to point, but a very well-accepted amount is three half shekel. The important reason, and I mentioned this last week as well, the important reason connecting the half shekel coin, the half shekel mitzvah, with Purim is not just the fact that in Adar it was done, but more significantly, as stated in Talmud Yerushalmi, is that our shekelim were the antidote to Haman's shkalim. Haman came before Ahasuerus and he says, I want to get rid of the Jews. They're not worth you to keep them in your kingdom. Let me do what I want with them. And I will sweeten the pot by bringing 10,000 silver talents to the royal treasury. 10,000 talents is the equivalent of 600,000 half shekels. One talent equals 30 shekels. Do the arithmetic and you come out with 600,000. 600,000 is the magic number that equals B'nai Yisrael. Regardless of our population, we are called the nation of 600,000. That's the description as we came out of Egypt. That's the description, by the way, of a multitude of Jews. If you, there, for example, this is off the topic, there is a bracha that is recited when you see a multitude of the Jewish people. What is a multitude? 600,000. But it's the number that represents Klal Yisrael because of those who came out of Egypt from age 20 above males. The population that came out of Egypt was 2 to 3 million, but it's still called 600,000. Our shekels were the antidote to Haman's shekels, meaning God would not let anything happen to us because of Haman's offer of 10,000 silver talents to the king, because we had already paid our dues, so to speak, of the half shekel. The other thing that you have to know is that this is a requirement, even though I said it was a custom before, it is a requirement of males, it is optional for females. And that is because the silver half shekel of the Beit HaMikdash was required of men, but optional for females, optional for women. Various customs follow, who you give for. They say on the books that even a man's wife is pregnant, he'll give an additional half shekel or three half shekels on behalf of the unknown fetus. It even says that if it turns out that it's a boy, he is committed to continue giving on his behalf till he's the age of mitzvot and could give on his own. If it's a girl, he does not have to continue that minhag since it's optional for girls, and assuming that he didn't know what it was going to be when she or he was still in the womb, he gave, but without a commitment to perpetuate that in the case it's a girl. In any event, that's the story, and it's done tomorrow, and any shul has collection plates from various different sources. Some shuls will line up 10, 20, 30 cardboard boxes printed by the yeshivot, and you give your zecher l'machatzit shekel for this place, for that place, for the other place, whatever. Here we are collecting, and I have intention of distributing it on Friday to needy people. Next, Ta'anit Esther. There's an element of Ta'anit Esther which relates very nicely to other issues, and I'll put them all together as follows. Let's look at it this way. All horns of kosher animals are accepted as shofar, with the exception of the horn of a cow, or anything in the cow family. Why? The traditional answer is, ein kategor nase sanegor. A horn of a cow represents a cow, which is associated with a calf, which is associated with the golden calf, which is associated with a serious sin of the people of Israel, and therefore it is not appropriate on Judgment Day, Rosh Hashanah, when you are calling people to repent, to use this damning piece of evidence against Bnei Yisrael. Rather, one should use the ram's horn, which reminds us of Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, and that's a good zechut. Fine. If that's what you're going to say, then explain to me the following. The very first animal sacrifice in the Mishkan, before it was set into full operation, in its 7 days of inauguration, the very first offering was a par, a bull. It was a par because of Chet HaEgel. So we are using as the vehicle of atonement for the sin of the golden calf, the bull, which is the symbolic father of the calf. The horn of a cow, we said, no, don't use that on Rosh Hashanah because not appropriate. Gold. The Kohen Gadol, when he enters Kodshei Kodashim, when he enters the Devir, which is what the Kodshei Kodashim was called, he removes his golden garments and he puts on pure white linen. Why? Because Ein Kategor Nase Sanegor. He is praying on behalf and acting on behalf of the atonement of the people of Israel. It would be not appropriate for him to use gold garments, garments containing gold, that are a damning piece of evidence against Bnei Yisrael for the same reason, the golden calf. Yet, what does he see when he gets into Kodshei Kodashim? He sees an Aron plated in gold. He sees a solid gold cover of the Aron, solid gold cherubs, kruvim, from the Aron. He sees the walls of Kodshei Kodashim and the Beit HaMikdash are plated with gold. He's bringing in with him a gold incense pan with glowing coals and incense. So, wait a minute. If
gold is a negative thing, and he's not supposed to go into Kodesh Kodashim wearing it, what's the significance of it being there? And, well, which is it? The answer is there, it's both. When God says, take off those gold garments, because that's a sensitive thing against Bnei Yisrael, and go in with white linen, then the Kohen Gadol does that. When God says, make the kaporet of the Oron and the Kruvim out of gold, then we do that. And we don't say, oh, excuse me, God, didn't you tell us that gold is not appropriate? No, I commanded you to remove the gold garments and go in with only white. I also commanded you to use gold when I command you to as an atonement for the Chayto Egel. Similarly, the shofar, the par, the cow, the red heifer, whatever is a positive thing of use of a cow as an atonement for Chayto Egel, we do. And when we are told you can have a shofar made of any material except for the horn of a cow, then we do that also. What does this all have to do with Tanit Esther? It has to do with wine. And it has to do with drinking and eating. The problem of the Jews in the time of Ahasuerus is that they enjoyed and went to the parties and had food and drink when Ahasuerus was displaying the plunder of the Beit HaMikdash, when he was using vessels, as the Megillah tells us, v'chelim mikelim shonim, vessels from various types, which the Meforshim say was the kelim of the Beit HaMikdash, when he was parading in the garments of the Kohen Gadol, and the Jews, with the notable exception of Mordechai, went to this party and had a good time. How can you have a good time? I used an example earlier, which is a frightening kind of thought, and I'm using it now in its milder description. So, if the problem which resulted in having a threat of Haman's destruction over our heads for almost a year was brought about symbolically by the eating and drinking of wine at these parties, then Purim observance turns out to be the following. On Purim, you will not only drink wine for the mitzvah of Purim, but you will drink in excess of your usual amount of consumption. L'shem mitzvah, for the sake of the mitzvah. And not only will you eat food, but you will party with it and have a su'udat Purim, which is a su'udat mitzvah. And you will take gifts of these foods and you will exchange them with your fellows. By the opposite token, but along the same goal, on the day before Purim, you will abstain from eating and drinking, also known as fasting. And both of those combine to be an appropriate atonement and tikkun, repair, for the problem. The mashal that I've given in the past for the gold and the gold and the cow and the cow and the calf and the calf applies here also. And that is to a child that was left alone at home for an hour while his parents went on some errands. And when they came back, they find that he had used his new box of Crayola crayons with the 128 colors and a built-in crayon sharpener by drawing beautiful pictures all over the walls of the apartment. So their first reaction is to be very upset and to yell and to punish. But look at what they do and how they punish, aside from grounding him till he's 30 years old or whatever. They take away his crayons and say, you will not use these crayons for a month. Then they sit him down after school the next day, and they give him paper and his crayons. And they say, we want you to spend the next hour not playing and not watching TV and not whatever, riding your bike. But you're going to draw beautiful pictures with these crayons, and then we're going to go to the local hospital, to the children's ward, and we're going to mount these pictures on their walls to help cheer them up. What do you mean you take away his crayons by punishing him not to use that with which he sinned, quote, and then using those very same crayons for a positive thing, which is exactly the point. It should not be viewed as a contradiction. I think it's a beautiful hand-in-hand. General use of your crayons, you're being punished, you cannot use them for the next month. Special use of these crayons, that will be your tikkun, your repair. It's almost like one is an onesh, a punishment, and the other is a tikkun. I don't know if it's perfectly analogous, but I feel it works. And if those are the thoughts that we have on Tanit Esther, tomorrow, it works. Tanit Esther is not a sad day. It's not in commemoration of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. It's not in mourning for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. It's not a sad day. It's a serious day. And it's a serious day that allows us to reflect on the serious aspects of Purim that we don't want to spend time on Purim doing. Purim is just not conducive to having a serious, sober meditation and thinking and discussion about why they got into trouble in the first place. And as an analogy to that, I often use the example of a kid that ran into the street and was hit by a car. Serious injuries, hospitalized for a long time, operation, another operation, recuperation, and Baruch Hashem, finally, after a long period of time, he's okay. To the point where his parents celebrate by inviting friends and family to a party in this kid's honor to thank God for his refuah and hachlama mihira. But that's only part of it. That's the celebration. At that party is not the place to give him a lecture on safety on the streets. The day before is, or the day after, or every other day, not at the party. The party is to thank God and to celebrate the kid's well-being. You don't want to spoil the fun by giving a lecture on running after a ball without looking where you're going and worrying more about the ball than about your safety. But you have to do that also. That is what I believe is Tanit Esther to Purim. Tanit Esther is there, built in, to be able to take away the sting that should be felt on Purim and feel it instead on the day before.
This by no means is the only reason given for the existence of Tanit Esther, but I find it's a very useful thing to apply to Tanit Esther and give us a good balance between the day of potential excesses, Purim, and control them a little with this reminder the day before. As promised, we will have St. George and the Dragonet by Stan Freberg, 1953, shortly.
I'm Rod Serling. You're listening to
Torah Tidbits Audio.
Rest your eyes.
This is the Purim issue, and when it comes to Purim, almost anything goes. So as I mentioned already, St. George and the Dragonet, it is a spoof on the old Dragnet series in warped honor of Purim. Here it is.
The legend you are about to hear is true. Only the needle should be changed to protect the record.
This is the countryside. My name is St. George. I'm a knight. Saturday, July 10th, 8:05 p.m. I was working out of the castle on the night watch when a call came in from the chief. A dragon had been devouring maidens. Homicide. My job. Slay him. You call me, Chief?
Yeah, it's the dragon again, devouring maidens. The king's daughter may be next.
Mm-hmm. You got a lead?
Nothing much to go on. Sid, you take that .45 automatic into the lab to have him check on it?
Yeah. You were right.
I was right?
Yeah. He was a gun. 8:22 p.m. I talked to one of the maidens who had almost been devoured. Could I talk to you, ma'am?
Who are you?
I'm St. George, ma'am. Homicide, ma'am. I want to ask you a few questions, ma'am. I understand you were almost devoured by the man. Is that right, dragon?
It was terrible. He breathed fire on me. He banged me already.
How can I be sure of that, ma'am?
Believe me, I got it straight from the dragon's mouth.
11:45 p.m. I rode over the King's Highway. I saw a man. Stopped to talk to him. Pardon me, sir. Could I talk to you for just a minute, sir?
Sure, I don't mind.
What do you do for a living?
I'm a knave.
Didn't they pick you up on a 903 last year for stealing tarts?
Yeah? So what, do you want to make a federal case out of it?
No, sir. We heard it was a dragon operating in this neighborhood. We just want to know if you've seen him.
Sure, I've seen him.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe him for me?
What's to describe? You see one dragon, you've seen them all.
Would you try and remember, sir, just for the record? We just want to get the facts, sir.
Well, he was, you know, he had orange polka dots.
Yes, sir.
Purple feet, breathing fire and smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And one big bloodshot eye right in the middle of his forehead, and, like that.
Notice anything unusual about him?
No, he's just a run-the-mill dragon, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, you can go now.
Hey, by the way, how are you going to catch him?
I thought you'd never ask. A dragon net. 3:05 p.m. I was riding back into the courtyard to make my report to the lab. Then it happened. It was a dragon.
Hey, I'm the fire-breathing dragon. You must be St. George, right?
Yes, sir.
I see you got one of them new 45 caliber swords.
That's about the size of it.
You slay me.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about.
What do you mean?
I'm taking in a 502. You figure it out.
What's the charge?
Devouring maidens out of season.
Out of season? You never pinned that rap on me. Do you hear me, cop?
Yeah, I hear you. I got you in a 412, too.
A 412? What's a 412?
Overacting. Let's go.
On September the 5th, the dragon was tried and convicted. His fire was put out, and his maiden devouring license revoked. Maiden devouring out of season is punishable by a term of not less than 50 or more than 300 years.
Hope you enjoyed that. And now to a major focus of mine. Sometimes I get into a groove and I bite down on something and don't let go. It was another look at Purim Mishulash, the triple Purim that we have in Yerushalayim. For the uninitiated listeners, let me just clarify. The 14th of the Hebrew month of Adar is Purim Day. That day, in our fixed calendar, can never fall on Shabbat. The 15th of Adar is the day called Shushan Purim, which is primarily the day observed as Purim in Jerusalem. There are other cities around Israel that, because of their questionable status as to whether they were walled cities in ancient times or not, or they're in the proper location or not, will take a stringency upon themselves, many of the Jews, and read Megillah and observe Purim not just on the 14th like everybody else, but also on the 15th. But the only place that really, really is the 15th of Adar is Jerusalem, so we'll call it Jerusalem Purim, even though its real name is Shushan Purim. When Shushan Purim falls on Shabbat, because of a ban on the reading of Megillah on Shabbat, for reasons which I won't go into now, we in Jerusalem read Megillah Thursday night and Friday, like everybody else in the world. And on Friday morning, Friday during the day, the mitzvah of Purim called Matanot Le'Evyonim, gifts to poor people, is also to be performed by Jerusalemites on the same day that everyone else is doing it, on Friday. On Shabbat, we say Al Hanisim in recognition of the miracles of Purim, both in Birkat HaMazon and in the Amidah at each service. And there's a special Torah reading on Purim morning in Yerushalayim, different from every place else. Around the world, Jewish communities take out one Torah, read Parshat HaShavua, which is Parshat Tzav, and that's it, because it's after their Purim. In Yerushalayim, it's officially our Purim, even though we will have read the Megillah the day before. And therefore, we take out two Torahs. In the first, we read the weekly portion of Tzav, like everybody else. And in the second Torah, we read the Purim Torah reading, which everyone else has read on Friday morning, which we don't. If that's not confusing, let's move on to Sunday, where the two remaining mitzvot of Purim, namely Su'uda, the festive meal with the excessive drinking of wine included, and Mishloach Manot, sending gifts of food and exchanging gifts of food with our fellows, those had not been done on Friday nor on Shabbat, are done on Sunday, giving Purim in Yerushalayim a three-day observance known as Purim Mishulash, which I translate as Triple Purim, and for the purpose of gag puns and plays on words, either Triple Purim or Triangular Purim because of the word Mishulash, which applies to a triangle. Now, putting aside all of the details, here is what I have said repeatedly and written about maybe not the why it is so, but certainly a very powerful message, lesson, and focus that comes from the existence of this Triple Purim in particular, and the split Purim observance between the 14th and 15th of Adar.
The Megillah, after Esther reveals Haman's plot to Achashverosh, after Haman is hanged, and the Jews are given permission to fight on the 13th of Adar, since the king foolishly refuses to rescind his decree. He allows them to issue another decree. And then the king reports to Esther the body count on the fighting on the 13th of Adar in Shushan. And he says to her, Uma Shelatech, what would you like? And I will give you Uma Bakashatech, Ode, what else do you want? And it shall be done. Esther asked for that second day of fighting on the 14th. And then the Megillah reports to us what happened. That on all over the kingdom of Achashverosh, on the 13th of Adar, the Jews fought, V'noach ba'arba asarbo, and they rested from their fight on the 14th. V'asa oto, and they made that day Yom Mishteh V'simcha, into a festive day. V'hayehudim asher b'shushan, the Jews in Shushan, on the other hand, nikalu b'shlosha asarbo, they gathered to fight on the 13th, uva'arba asarbo, and on the 14th of Adar, v'noach, and they rested b'chamisha asarbo, on the 15th day, V'asa oto Yom Mishteh V'simcha. And they made that day, the 15th, into a festive day. This does not yet fix Purim. This tells us historically what happened in that year. Al Kain, therefore, Hayehudim HaPrazim HaYoshvim Ba'orei HaPrazot, and we usually translate Ir Paruz as a Pruza, as an open city, an unwalled city. They make the 14th of Adar as a Simcha Umishta V'yom Tov U'mishloach Manot Ish L'Reyehu. The Megillah does not tell us about the Jews in walled cities. It says the Jews in open cities make the 14th their Purim. Mordechai writes all of this down, and he sends scrolls to all of the Jews, Asher b'chol medinot ha-melech ha-chashverosh, who are in all of the provinces of the king, ha-kirovim v'ha-rechokim, the ones who are near and the ones who are far. What? Now listen to the change here. L'kayem aleihem, to keep or accept for themselves, l'hiyot osim, et yom arba'a asar l'chodesh adar, v'et yom chamisha asar bo, b'chol shana v'shana. To make the day of the 14th and the 15th every year, kayamim asher nachu bahem hayhudim me'oyveihem v'achodesh asher nepach lahem yogon l'simcho me'eva l'yom tov, to mark and celebrate the days and the month where everything turned over and we went from sadness to joy and from mourning to festival, l'hiyot otam, la'asot otam, to make them Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha, days of parties and joy, U'mishloach Manot Ish L'Reyehu, U'matanot Lev Yonim, and to send gifts to each other, and gifts to the poor. Notice that it didn't separate the Jews in open cities from the Jews in Shushan or the Jews in walled cities. Mordechai's decree was that we shall perpetuate the celebration of the Purim story in future years, b'chol shana v'shana, in every year, as 2 days of festival. V'kibel ha-Yehudim asher hechelu la'asot ve'et kol ketav Mordechai aleihem. And the Jews accepted that which Mordechai wrote to them. Al-Kain, karu la'yamim, I'm skipping a little, therefore they called these days, plural, Purim, al-Shem ha-Pur, they named it Purim because of the lot that Haman threw to vanquish the Jews. Al kain al kol divrei ha'igeret hazot v'chulei v'chulei. Kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim aleihem va'al zaron. They accepted upon themselves, for themselves, and their children and children's children forever. 8 shnei hayamim ha'ele. These 2 days. Now, we think of these 2 days as the 14th is regular Purim for the rest of the world, and the 15th is Purim in Yerushalayim. But the Megillah seems to say that these are 2 days of festivities. They are called again, Yemei HaPurim Ha'ele, these Purim days. Now, I would like to suggest that the original intention was to have a 2-day festival called Purim. Seems that the original intention was to have a 2-day festival called Purim. What Chazal did with it is split between all open cities and villages and towns that observe Purim on the 14th of Adar, and cities such as Shushan and those like Shushan, which means walled cities, should observe only the 15th. Then they said, well, this is not nice for Yerushalayim, because Yerushalayim at the time of the Purim story was in ruin and it didn't have a wall. So they said, okay, we will define walled cities as having a wall from the time, not of Purim, but from the time of the conquest of Yehoshua. That, on a homiletical level, on a drash level, allows us to associate Yehoshua, who not only brought the people into Eretz Yisrael and conquered and settled the land, but he was the one who went out to fight against Amalek in the first case. So what, in essence, Chazal did was say, we want to link Amalek with their descendant Haman and what he tried to do, and they do it in a few ways. One was Parshat Zachor, which was remember Amalek, and that's always the week before Purim. A second way is the Torah reading of Purim is Vayavo Amalek, the story of Amalek. And they made a further association by defining a walled city as a city that had a wall from the time of the conquest of Yehoshua. Why mention Yehoshua? It gives prominence to Jerusalem, and it associates Yehoshua, who fought against Amalek, with Mordechai, who fought against the descendant of Amalek. But then, look at the practical side of it. What cities observe Shushan Purim? Yerushalayim. What other cities? Well, the fact is, there is no other place that observes Shushan Purim the way we do, meaning exclusively the 15th. Yerushalayim as the only definite, no argument about it. And then he lists other cities where there is a dispute. Even this year, we're not observing Purim on the 14th of Adar. We're reading Megillah. Now that sounds like, well, what do you call that? That certainly sounds like observing Purim. The point is, we have a ban, a halachic rabbinic ban on the reading of Megillah on Shabbat, and therefore we have no choice but to read Megillah Thursday night and Friday like the rest of the world. But it isn't Purim. And the Svarim that write about it say, you have to make an announcement at Ma'ariv of Megillah reading, do not say Al Hanisim. Because the natural tendency is, you're dressed up for Purim, you're either in nice clothes or you're in a costume, and they have that atmosphere in the shul, and the lights are different, and everybody's anticipating Megillah reading, and it's exciting. But it's not Purim in Yerushalayim. Friday morning, you don't read the Torah. You always read the Torah on Purim morning. We're going to read it on Shabbat, because Shabbat is our Purim. Friday morning, we're going to read Megillah, because we have no choice. But it isn't Purim. I mean, obviously, it's Purim-y. but it's not Purim Day. Otherwise, Chazal would have said, read Megillah and say Al HaNisim. They didn't say that. They said, read Megillah. Al HaNisim, Friday night, Shabbos. No Megillah, Al HaNisim, Friday night, Shabbos. Shabbos mornings, two Torahs, a Torah reading for Purim in addition to a Torah reading for the week. Why did it end up, or what lesson comes from the fact that Yerushalayim takes such an obvious, unique place in Purim when Purim didn't even happen here? That's the point, I believe. You can't forget Yerushalayim or leave Yerushalayim out of the picture because the Purim story happened because we were exiled from Yerushalayim and from Eretz Yisrael. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan Abirah. There was a Jew who lived in Shushan. And his name was Mordechai ben Yair ben Shim'i ben Kish Ish Yemini, a descendant of the tribe of Benjamin. The description doesn't stop there. That would be enough. The Megillah goes one step further, and it switches to the tune of Eicha to remind us of the sad circumstances. Asher Hagla Mirushalayim. He was exiled from Jerusalem. That's the Mordechai we're talking about, but it's more than that. There are a lot of other people in Shushan and elsewhere in the kingdom of Ahasuerus who were exiled from Yerushalayim. Why do we identify Mordechai as Asher Hagla Mirushalayim? Because he was the standout individual who remembered Avelut, the sadness and the mourning of the loss of Yerushalayim. When our commentaries ask, how come? What did we do to deserve the threat of Haman? You know, we look at Purim and we say, Haman's plot did not succeed, Baruch Hashem. But for one full year, from the middle of Nisan, the previous year, all the way through till Adar, we had a sword over the head of the Jewish communities in the kingdom of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus could not, would not, did not rescind the order, and the Jews lived for almost a full year under the threat of the sword of Haman and his people. You could say they lived under the threat of Katyuska rockets and Qassam rockets. Under that threat, did they succeed? No, they didn't. But that's no consolation when you have a feeling of discomfort and panic for such a long period of time. That's why they celebrated when they finally were out of that panic. But it was because, say the commentaries, why did we deserve it? Because we forgot that we were in exile. We got to like living in Shushan and places like Shushan. The king invited us all to his party, and we went, and we drank, and we ate, and we enjoyed. And what was at that party? That party is where the king was parading in the garments of the Kohen Gadol that he had stolen from the Babylonians who plundered it from the Beit HaMikdash. He set out vessels which were kelim mikelim shonim, the Megillah says, and that's another custom, to read those words in the Eicha Tum, because Rashi tells us and other commentaries tell us these were kelim, silver and gold kelim, from the Beit HaMikdash. A Jew should not have celebrated. If I can't get this point across, let me use it in a very, very harsh way. Imagine a Jew after World War II using a wallet that was made from the cloth of a Sefer Torah. We wouldn't do that. A Jew would never take something that the Nazis profaned. We would tear Kriya if we saw such a thing. The Jews in Shushan should have torn Kriya. They should have boycotted, no matter what the penalty would be, a party which was Ahasuerus boasting that he was superior to the God of Israel. But only Mordechai's voice was raised against that. And that's why we were subjected to Haman's threat for that year. Why we were saved is another story. But that kind of forgetting Yerushalayim is something that was disgraceful, to say the least. And I believe that's why built into Purim for all generations is a focus on Yerushalayim. Jews who live here know this. Jews who live outside of Yerushalayim know it well. I have my son lives in Yerushalayim, and my brother lives in Yerushalayim. I'm coming from Beersheba to spend Shabbos in Yerushalayim. What do I have to do? Should I say Al Anisim here, or should I say it at the end of the Shmoneh Esrei? Everybody here, on a practical level, is involved with Shilas. But even Jews who live elsewhere and are not in Israel are aware of the fact that there's a triple Purim in Yerushalayim this year, and it highlights Yerushalayim. Shushan is mentioned 19 times in the Megillah, and I believe every single one is to rub it in, to say, what are you doing in Shushan? You don't belong in Shushan. You should have been on your way back to Eretz Yisrael already. By this time of the Purim story, Jews had permission to return to Eretz Yisrael. What were they doing in Shushan? They were living it up. And therefore, when the Megillah speaks of Shushan, 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 but there's one other city that the Megillah mentions, only once, and that's Yerushalayim. And what got built in for all time is a celebration of Purim, where Yerushalayim is a major factor.
Here's the punchline. Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, if we forget the Yerushalayim factor in the Purim story, tishkach yemini. Forget about Mordechai, he's the yemini. This is a drush. But Purim loses part of its meaning, maybe most of its meaning, without the Jerusalem factor on our minds. On that note, let me wish you, wherever you live, in Yerushalayim, in Eretz Yisrael, anywhere in the world, Purim Sameach, Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameach.